Welcome to the Booktopia podcast. My name is Sarah and I am here today with the amazing Kirsty Eager and the amazing Justine LaBellestia. Did I nail that or did I totally ruin it?
No,
perfect. You nailed it.
Excellent. So we're doing something a little bit different this time around on the Booktopia podcast. We're actually going to be talking about two very separate, very different books. Which one are we going to talk about first? How do we settle this? Will we flip a coin? Are we going to go alphabetical?
Well, do you want to talk about sex first? Or do you want to talk about
psychopaths? Yes. Psychopaths or sex?
Really? We could do rock, scissors, paper really quickly. Do you want to do that? There you go. Quick.
One, two, three. We've got scissors versus scissors.
Oh, we're very like-minded.
One, two, three. Rock versus rock. Oh, my God. You guys are mentally connected.
Yay.
Justine is going first, which means...
I won, so we're doing Kirsty first.
Oh, I see. So we're not vying for first position, we're vying for second position.
Oh, okay, yeah. Okay.
In which case, Kirsty, you're up first, right. And we're talking about Summer Skin.
Okay.
I loved both of these books.
Thank
you. Very different reasons, because as I mentioned, they're very different books. First of all, what I wanted to talk to you about this was, we're marketing it 17 and up. Do you think that means that it's YA still, or is it a new adult book?
I think, yeah, it's a really good question. Mm-hmm. To me, and this is a big discussion I had with my agent once it was written as well, I still think it's YA. I just think that YA is stretching. That's my view. Or maybe it's always been stretched, really. Have we ever had a time when YA wasn't, you know, somewhat controversial in terms of people not always liking the fact that there's certain issues we touch on? There's never been a time when it's not been...
People always raise their eyebrows when it goes anywhere near sexual content in YA.
Yes.
I remember when I was at school, we did Looking for Ella Brandy, and everyone was like totally like spun out by the sexual content in that book, which looking back was nothing.
Sexual content?
It was like a makeout scene on the bed with like references to, I think, sex. That's like vague references. But everyone lost it because that back then was a big deal. This obviously has like more.
Yeah, this is the book about sex. So there's going to be content. So I set out to write a book that looked at it. So, yeah, there was always going to be content. But what's been funny, I was just saying to Justine on the way here, is that I had a few comparisons. People kept saying to me, have you read Forever by Judy Blume? And I hadn't read it, so I was very embarrassed to admit that. But I've now got a copy and I'm reading it. And I'm actually thinking, well, I can see why they're making the comparison, because there is that content. And then for me too, it really affirmed for me that, yeah, content in YA is nothing new at all. So it's been there. That's 40 years old now, that book. So, yeah.
I've never read it by now. I feel embarrassed.
Well, yeah, I've finished it. It's in my handbag. I'll mail it back to you. You can have a read. But, I don't think... Like, to me, the argument... It's a funny thing, because my first book published was Raw Blue, and that also had content. And what was interesting to me was... I've had this discussion with Justine about quiet censorship. So perhaps it suffered from quiet censorship. That's Justine's term, not mine. But I think it's a really good term for what happens. But it was funny because I expected there to be some sort of backlash, and there really wasn't. And if anything, I had people coming up to me quietly saying, yeah, I really like that you put that in there. I really like the fact that you're going there. So I don't, you know, it's a funny thing. I wonder if we're more worried about imagined gatekeepers than I just don't know. I know that Justine will have... Yeah, you can go for it, because you will have a view on that. Yeah, and you've been doing it for longer, you'll know.
Well, I mean, it's really interesting. I mean, I loved Summer Skin, and I would have adored it at 12, you know? Because, like, I mean, I was going through my mother just gave me a whole bunch of my old papers and juvenilia and report cards, and I'm figuring out where to put it, and was putting it with my old diaries, and I hadn't looked at them for years, and I was looking at stuff I wrote at 11 or 12, and I was obsessed with sex. I was like curious and reading stuff and wanting to know, and you know, and that book would have totally spoken to me as a 12-year-old, you know. And yet, I mean, the idea that only 17-year-olds are adults, you know.
Yeah.
And I mean, I think Summer Skin is totally going to work for adults. But the feel of it to me is totally YA.
Yeah,
and 100%. I think there are going to be 12 and ups who are going to be really into it and totally love it. I think when we talk about all of that stuff, we're really talking about the parents. We're really talking about... teens will pick up a book, and if they're into it, they're into it. And if they're not, they're not. you know, but it's the parents and, you know, so, yeah, I mean, the thing about quiet censorship is, you know, it was quietly suggested to me with a couple of my books that if I change something, it would get into more schools in the US. It would be picked up by the Scholastic Book Club. And, you know, and I'm like, with that particular book, it didn't matter. So I was okay. It was some, you know, so I did that. But with your book, it's about sex.
You wouldn't cut it.
You have to, you know.
And I really object to drawing a line and saying, we can talk about everything else, but we can't talk about sex. I just think that's betraying. I think that's hanging people out to dry. And it just, I don't ever want to be like that. So,
especially if you want to write a relevant book about youth culture at the moment, it would be a glaring oversight.
Yeah. And it's sort of funny because I grew up with a mum who was very open and honest. So I don't, it's really weird. I've never been... Because someone did ask me, oh, did you have trouble writing the sex stuff? And I said, no, I really enjoyed it, you know, and it's quite honest. I really, it doesn't bother me at all. You know, I just try and keep it really honest to the characters and that's about it. I don't stress about it.
Yeah.
So, it will be interesting.
So then, just because I'm still on the fence as to whether I believe in new adult as a genre or not. Like, I think, as you were saying earlier, that young adult has stretched. Probably because people's length of perceived childhood is much longer now than it used to be. Like, you can still be, like, essentially leading a childlike existence of well into your 20s now, with, you know, people delayed moving out of home and, like, longer university experiences and stuff. So I think that it's young adult, but it's, like, young adult of now, not young adult of Judy Blume's time. However many correlations there might be there.
Yeah, and it's funny, I've had this discussion with some other authors and also publishers as well, so I'm sure this is not... I'm sure it's not me being unique in saying this, but I've often had that thought of... Belinda Jeffrey, an author friend of mine, had said to me ages ago, she thinks of YA and then she thinks of teen fiction. And I thought, you know what, to me that's quite a good way. It's too complicated, and I know as booksellers you can't... It becomes more divisive and you can't... It's difficult to do that. But in my mind, I think, well, it's labelled young adult. So really, you're looking at things, whether people are ready for them at 12, or, which I would be the same. I was a big reader. I was reading Lace at around that age and enjoying it. So
it's what you're interested in at that age, because it's the great unknown when you're 12 and stuff. That's your
plan of the
kid. Yeah. Oh, my God, I remember reading that too.
Flowers in the attic. Jackie Collins books and all of that.
Yeah.
Banging and shopping.
Bonkbusters.
Yeah, you seek it out. And I think the great thing about Summer Skin is if you're young and you're seeking out a book that is going to tell you about sex, this book is so honest and has so many great role models, I think, particularly for young women. I found it so refreshing to read. Because Jess is like... I've been in love with her. Like, she's smart. Oh, but, you know, she's 19, right? So, like, hopefully that ends. Yeah. That's just a phase.
She quit for Justine.
But, yeah, I thought she was great. And I thought as well, a moment that stood out for me was Farron and how she addressed not wanting to... for the listeners to the podcast, there's a character in Summer Skin who... it's a sexual assault, I guess, was filmed having sex unknowingly. And then later makes the decision not to come forward and bring her accusers into the light because, and that is viewed in this book and put forward as a really strong decision. And I think that's great because we've heard the story so many times of the brave woman who comes forward and brings justice to her accusers, but I haven't been exposed much to the decision not to, which is just as valid and just as strong. So I'm babbling now.
No, but, like, that's awesome. Thank you, Sarah, because I think that's something I think people will take a stance on, and that's completely fine. But my view's always been the focus needs to shift to the men, usually, who do these things. It's not about the person who's had it done to them. Whatever they need to do to survive is fine. Like, that's their choice. Like, no one else gets to dictate the terms of their survival, and that's always been my stance. And Raw Blue, the first book, was the same. I think there's far too much pressure on the woman and how she responds and whether she stands up you know, becomes sort of a symbol of that. And I can completely understand how you might want to. Recently on Twitter, Nina Fennell's just done this great article on how if you're exposed to some sort of sexual harassment, often your first reaction to that is actually not fight or flight, it's just to freeze. And I thought, you know, I relate to that so much. I think often we freeze and then we feel really guilty because we didn't stand up and be very, you know, verbal and loud, but often many of us can't do that. So, and Farron's reaction too, I thought it felt very true to Farron, in that she had a firm view. And I went, you know, when I went through college, because I spent 4 years in a residential college, like one of the girls I went through with was Kirsten Livermore. Now she became the Member of Parliament in my area, you know, Capricornia, where I'm from. So, you know, there were a lot of girls I went through like that with very strong views on where they were going in life. And I always felt Farron was that way, and that she had a sense that she wanted to run for president the next year, and she did run for president the next year. And she wasn't going to let that thing derail her or define who she was.
So, yeah, and you know, she makes that point that she didn't run for president to prove that.
Yeah.
She wasn't being defined by it. She went because she always wanted to, and it was a separate thing from what had happened to her.
Yeah.
Which I just, like, I haven't really come up, I'm familiar with other representations of sexual assault in fiction. I haven't really come across a character like Farron. I thought she was great.
Oh, great.
Like, I thought she was really strong and really stood out for me in the book. And as I said, I've got a huge crush on Jess. Like, she's amazing. And I also thought, so Mitch, because this is a romance, it's bigger than a romance, but at the core of the story is a really sweet, adorable, rocky romance. And I found Mitch a really great character because in YA, we often have this perfect guy that, and it's insta-love, and it's like, you know, there's just no suggestion really ever that the guy has done anything wrong. Or has any character flaws, really. He might be unavailable for reasons, but you never really see someone who's got to work through their personality. And I felt like the personality development for Mitch in this book was astonishing.
Oh,
like,
good.
From the time he first shows up, where you're just not sure what's going on there, he doesn't seem like a very nice guy, and then throughout the book, how he grows and changes, like, that was amazing to me.
Good. Because unfortunately we will meet a lot of Mitches around who don't change. But I think there is that potential with people that can't, you know, anyone's capable of redemption, I suppose, or change. Or,
and it wasn't it wasn't an easy journey for him.
No.
And it was very much the relationship which changed him. And the relationship here is interesting as well, because in this book is an examination of how the youth today, being part of this like overly exposed social media, like porn generation, how they navigate emotional relationships and intimacy, which I find, I've never really thought about it in terms of romance. Like,
yeah, it's funny. The seed. Oh, sorry.
Go.
But hijacking. Yeah, there's two things there. I thought too with Mitch, I don't feel he would have. I wonder what you think, because I think, you know, your character's a character, but you don't have the last word, really. So I feel like with him, he was cracked open a little bit by what had happened.
Mm.
So I think that had made him question himself just enough for Jess to work with him a bit, I think. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
I feel like, I don't know what your take is, because she might have been fine with him anyway, I don't know, but I felt like it had just given him pause in terms of his own behaviour enough that he was questioning.
Sort of
I don't know, but that's my view, and yours could be completely different.
No, I totally saw it like that. Yeah. I kind of found it interesting because in the bare bones of the story, it could be boy meets girl, girl changes boy.
Mm.
And girl are happy, but it's not really, that's not really what happens. It's more like boy and girl meet in a state of flux and sort of affect each other both to the positive, and perhaps like the boy gets a little bit more of a positive change to his personality, just kind of remains sort of solid throughout the whole thing. But
he needed more work.
He did. He needed a lot more work. He was a very unhappy guy, and he ends off in a pretty good place, and that is like largely due to his relationship.
I was going to say that thing you were saying too about... I was struck when I was writing this, I already had the idea for it, and I sort of knew where I was going in terms of general direction, in terms of what you're saying, in terms of, I think I say their generation porn somewhere there in the book, in terms of, just as this generation have got that access that we had through our reading at 11 and 12, obviously, but we didn't have this internet access.
I mean, what I was going to say, I mean, that all this stuff about, I'm very skeptical, and incapable of saying words of more than one syllable, about generation porn, because, like, I remember when I was a teenager, I was, as we were saying, hugely curious about sex, and reading lots of books with sex in them, and and boys I knew were and some girls were finding like their dad's porn stash, and
it's not a new thing
at all, and we're curious, and I really don't think that I mean, obviously there are always generational differences, but I really don't think that's actually a particularly big one. When you actually talk to teens about it, what I'm mostly struck about when I talk to teens is how much smarter they are. I was an idiot at the same age.
No, of course you weren't, and I think that's the big thing. I think the only thing that concerns me really, and there's two things you said. The one, because I'm talking too much, but the one thing I'm struck by too, and this is something I've always thought, and I hope it comes through in that book. Girls are so sexually curious.
Yes.
Girls have libidos, and we seek the stuff out equally, and girls get turned on, and that's okay. There's nothing wrong with that. And the only thing.
And you really capture that just definitely. So well. Oh, yeah. Really, like, she's so clearly a sexual being, and it's so clearly a part of who Jess is. You know, like, she's very smart, and she's very curious, and she has this wonderful group of friends, and it's, there are all these kind of complicated, really cool things about her, and, she's also, like, really likes sex. And it's so wonderful to see a character like that.
I think it's funny, that thing there with Jen Porn. Sorry, I've just completely gone back to it. Back to me.
All linked in, and we are discussing your book.
I'll wind it up in a sec. But that, just that Jen Porn thing too. I think what's changed is the nature of the content, that's for sure. Because I do, that does disturb me a little bit, just in terms of if it's more violent, or if it's the way that women are portrayed sometimes.
And just how accessible it is.
Yeah, once again, I would be seeking it out if I was a teen. But
would it be that easy? It's in previous generations, to come across the most violent, horrific one you can imagine.
No. Even just if you don't choose, sometimes you come across it accidentally. But what I was going to say as well, it's not even, when I was writing it, part of it was too, not even really so much about that as I remember clearly getting to college, and it was that, and I say something in there about it, but it's that moment when in high school it's all about whether you will or you won't have sex, and then you get to uni and it's like, oh wow, it's the game changes. I don't remember that at college. And it was like, wow, it's just,
it's who you're going to have sex with, and what's your relationship going to be like.
And I found,
what kind of sex will you have.
Yeah, what you'll do, and what you'll be asked to do, and just the way that everyone, it was very open, and everyone talked about it, and there were some really good things about that, and there were some other things about that that made you feel pressured sometimes. And I think that's what I was addressing as well. It's intergenerational in that sense. Like, we've all been at that point where suddenly you think, wow, it's become a whole lot more sophisticated, and I'm not sure I'm quite, at the stage yet ready to your mind's a bit blown. So it was partly that as well,
To jump back as well, because I agree with everything that you just said, and that all comes through really, really strongly in the book, which is again what I found so, when I was reading it, I was consistently pleasantly surprised. Like, every chapter just gave me something to be like, oh wow, okay, the character is honestly saying this, and it's all just happening in a really authentic way. But to return to talking about Jess and her strengths, one thing that I really liked about her so much was that it's so easy when you set out to write a book that deals with gender politics and you want a strong female character. It's so easy, and you see it so often, that character is distilled to I'm sassy and I'm strong. I'm going to tell boys what I think, but that's it. And it's a bit flat. With Jess, she's a layered character. She has moments of vulnerability. You never feel like her whole point in the book is to be the strong girl schooling the boy. Even though she does do that, she also is disarmingly honest with him and vulnerable with him and really real. And so that's all I want to say,
you can come and live with me. You can come and sit in my office and tell me things like that all day long. Thank you very much.
Jess is also political. I mean, I mean, I don't want to give the listener the wrong impression. This is actually a funny book too, and it's warm. And I read it in basically like two sittings, you know. And I would have read it in one, but you know, I had to catch a plane. You know, like it's a page turner. It's really hard to put down. There's a lot going on. And
you can come and live with me too. I love you too.
But it is also quite a political book, and what I love about that book is that a lot of the current conversations about rape culture, you know, about slut shaming and about how young women get to perform themselves and be themselves in the world without being punished and criticized, and you know, all of that is all there, but you know, not in an overt, you know,
not in a special episode of the show type way. We're educating the kids now. It's a story, but it contains all of that.
And it's, I mean, it's a very hard thing to do when you're writing a book is because, like, in our everyday lives, like, I go out to dinner with my mates and we have, like, huge arguments about, you know, discussing, like, Bill Cosby and you know, Roman Polanski and, like, these long-going scandals and talking about sexual politics and agency and how women own their own bodies and how, you know, like, the Chris Gayle thing, like, how that kind of systemic way men are taught to just see women as sexual objects and nothing else, and we have these conversations all the time, but if people have them in a book, it's just like, it seems weird.
It feels educational hour. It's often, but not here, which is what's so great.
To actually talk about those really important things around sex and gender and race and class in a book is it's really hard to write, and Kirsty nails it.
But you've nailed it in yours as well. That's something I loved about my sister Rosa
we're
as
not
well.
Up to my
yeah, okay.
Was that you segueing? Like,
Kirsty only likes a certain amount of praise. But no, I mean, I mean, obviously, that specifically about this book. But you know, when you want to talk about all those things and have them in your novels, I mean, it is a constant kind of tension, and you do get editorial feedback saying nobody talks like that, and I'm like, my friends do. We talk like this all the time. This is what we talk about. And the teens, when I do, you know, school visits or when I talk with lots of different teens on Twitter, or you know, these are the questions they're talking about. They're talking about identity and how it's an intersectional politics, and how they deal with being, you know, a trans boy, you know, an African American trans boy at this moment in time. This is this one kid I talked to on Twitter, and these are conversations that we have, and they're saying like, I want to see this in books, and I'm like, it's like the narrative fights you when you try to. It is incredibly hard to do, but you nailed it.
Oh, thank you.
It does seem like it would be a bit of a tightrope. I think the reason, like, it works so well here is because you're so invested in the story, you never break out of it. Like, every character who has something important to say on those topics, or who is, in a sense, getting on a soapbox, does it so in character and so within the flow of the story that you never break out of it. And it's only when you finish it that you're just like, God, there's a lot of meat there. Because essentially I'm reading it and I'm invested in Mitch and Jess. Like, that's, I read it for that reason. I want them to get together. I want to see what happens. Occasionally want them not to get together, but then I think, no, I do. Like, so like, I'm in it for that. And it's just when you end it and you're just like, wow, like, you think back and you're like, they talked about that, all these really important topical issues, but it doesn't feel like a topical book. Like, it doesn't feel like that at all.
Do you think that's because they also take the piss out of a lot of it though too?
Well, the humor really helps. I thought that
afterwards, it wasn't a conscious thing. I think I just wanted something that made me laugh, and then I was thinking when I was writing it, wow, you can get away with a lot when you
inject humor.
If you've got some, yeah, it's a difficult thing, but if you've got that tone, you can sort of be a lot more...
you have a lot more leeway.
Yeah, I felt it gave me a bit of freedom, to be honest, yeah.
And that initial sex, invert, I mean, I'm doing air quotes, because it's not really a sex
it does
thing, but it's hilarious, it's really funny.
And hot, though.
Like, yeah, it is kind of like, hot as well.
It's got it all, like, there's no moment in this book where it's not doing at least two or three things at once, which is amazing.
But he's also, like, completely humiliated.
Yeah.
Mm. Awesomely, totally deserves it.
But doesn't react the way that you would expect this kind of jockey guy that you think he is, at that, which he
and
is at that
did,
stage.
I've had feedback too, some people, well, we can't without spoilering. But yeah, some people said, I'm going to spoil it. I can't go there. They were shocked that Jeff, anyway, they were a bit shocked.
That she would like someone like.
No, that she would do that.
I think it seems in character.
Yeah. I just thought, that's, we would, oh, I don't know. And I really, thought my friends and I would, we totally did things like that. And also I thought too, I didn't want her, I wanted her to, it's that thing where you want, your girls are allowed to be bad. Girls can behave equally appallingly, which is not something we're aiming for.
And
but
she gets called on it, like Farron calls her on it, and it's like it was the wrong thing to do. Mm. And you get the sense that she does sort of regret what she did. But at no point did I feel like it was bad she did it, because she set out to do this thing that we're not mentioning in the podcast because it's super secret and you should read the book. But she sets out to do something, you know, that's possibly not the best moral decision ever made.
But ethically, it's a terrible thing to do.
She has good reason, though. She's very got good very reason. Good, loyal, kind-hearted reasons for wanting to do this revenge-y thing.
And I cheered as a reader.
I did too. And also, it felt really true to the character because she kind of almost doesn't do it a few times. Like, it feels like, oh, is she going to go through with it?
And then
like,
he
almost asks for it. Like, if he hadn't done this or said that, she might have done a different thing. But we're getting way too vague.
This unspecified thing happened at an unspecified time.
Get the book and read it because you're not going to regret it. Summer Skin, Kirsty Eager.
Thank you.
Love,
Sarah.
love. Now it might be time to switch books. We will now go on to My Sister Rosa. So, I don't even know where to begin here. This book genuinely frightened me, like genuinely gave me the creeps, but also was just so moving. Like, and I think that in part is because of your protagonist, who I just love.
Aww.
Jay. Yeah. where did your idea first come from this? Because it's an unusual sort of story.
Okay.
In Barespoons podcast listeners, this is the story of a young 17-year-old boy who is kind of dealing with a little 10-year-old sister who's...
psychopath.
Yes. I was going to go with antisocial personality disorder, but let's just say she's a psychopath.
She does have antisocial personality disorder. She is a psychopath.
Mm, so
and they're basically synonyms. The DSM is like the American Psychiatrist Bible. And they don't use the word psychopath or sociopath or any of the other
things. I was going to ask you about this. Yeah,
they call it antisocial personality disorder.
And is that considered a broad spectrum or is that...
There is sort of... the thing about psychopathy, about antisocial personality disorder, is... I mean, it's not like measles. Like, you can diagnose measles, right? Mm-hmm. But it's a set of things. So basically, people who are diagnosed with it exhibit almost no empathy. They feel no remorse or guilt. A lot of them have all these sorts of thrill-seeking tendencies. They self-aggrandize a lot. Mm-hmm. They lie. You know, if you ask them a question, like, often you will have this experience with someone with this disorder, and they will literally have just done something, you know, like just slapped their little sister, and you'll say,
Did you do that?
Yeah. And they'll say no, and you just saw them do it. You know, but some of them are smarter than others. I mean, another symptom is that they're promiscuous. But each category, there are like... There are social decisions, and they say a lot about our own morality, because like promiscuity is not actually a disorder. And like, how do you define being promiscuous? I mean, some people like to have multiple sexual partners. So are you promiscuous if you've had more than 2, 3, 4, like, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
So it's a bunch of different stuff. So I think the core of it is about having a conscience and empathy. So that is the core. And Che's 10-year-old sister, Rosa, does not have empathy and does not have guilt or remorse. She has no conscience.
And no concept of what good is. And no real concept of what love is.
No.
And it's even, I was going to say on that too, what are your thoughts then? Because she, and I'm like taking her then as representative, she's almost seeking out, she almost enjoys seeing empathy or sadness or something like that in other people, doesn't she? She almost manipulates to get that, get in touch with those emotions that she herself doesn't actually feel. So is that sort of something representative, or is that?
I
find that interesting. Yeah.
I don't think she does it out of wanting to feel what other. I mean, I think she just enjoys fucking with people.
And making people feel. Yeah.
I mean, she
it's
really
the control that she
sees
has.
Everyone else as basically a doll, like, you know, something that. It's for Rosa, it's whether people are useful or not.
Mm.
And if she can get you to do what she wants you to do, you know, and she, like, to her, it's like the whole world is a chess game and she's just figuring out how to get the pieces where she wants the pieces, how to get what she wants. And that's how she sees everything and that's how she operates. You know.
And it is utterly chilling to see, to just because it feels like every time you're getting a grip on who Rosa is and the depth of how horrifying it is, she'll just do something else that makes you reassess that.
And she's like, disarming in her honesty as well. That's what I found real. It's almost like you give her the benefit of the doubt as a reader, because then she'll be completely honest with Che, and you're like, wow, she's so honest about it, she can't be all that bad. But then you think, well, she's actually being very honest about stuff that is extremely, extremely
it's
bad.
It's terrifying, but funny? There's something disarming about how almost sweet it is that she has this little relationship with Che, where she'll be like telling him everything and being really honest and genuinely asking him to explain concepts like goodness. And like, I don't understand how what I did was bad when what she did was clearly bad. Like, but she just doesn't get it. And God, it was just like, this was reading this book is like, you're on the edge of your seat the whole time, and you just want everything to be okay, and you know it's not going to be okay. Like, that was the thing. Like, you feel like this can't end well, this can't end well, this can't end well, and but you can't get off the journey, like, because it's just utterly compelling. What I wonder is, like, you must have had so much fun researching this.
Well, the idea started actually with The Bad Seed, which is a novel from the 1950s, and blanking on the guy's name, William March, maybe? That sounds right. So he wrote this book in the 1950s that was, and he did a lot of research on what they knew about psychopathy at the time. And it's told from the point of view of the mother, whose 10-year-old daughter is, as she slowly becomes aware, you know, a psychopath.
Mm.
And is really good at pretending to be good around everyone else, but her mask keeps slipping with her mother. And one of my favorite American writers, Tayari Jones, on Twitter was talking about The Bad Seed. So it was actually her tweets kind of, and then I was talking about it with Scott, and he said, wouldn't a YA version be really interesting? I was like, oh yeah, from the point of view of a teenage sibling having this monster child, you know, what would that be like? And I started, writing it shortly after that. And initially, the older sibling was a girl.
Oh, okay.
And that didn't work at all. I just couldn't get it. And then I switched to it being a boy, and that worked better. But I still couldn't get a handle on the character. It took me a long time to figure out who Che was. And part of that is he's such a nice guy. Like, he's such an empathetic, loving human being. And he tells you, because this is first person narration, so it's all I this and I that. He tells you that he thinks everybody's a psychopath when he first meets them, but then you see him meeting people and he's actually assuming the best of everybody.
He's so open. Yeah. He's really, I really thought he was a wonderful character. And just, and it surprised me to hear you say you had trouble getting a handle on him. Because I thought, I had that moment when I read this and thought, oh, Justine was born to write this.
He's so well drawn. He's so lovable.
So well drawn, yeah.
Well, it was a real struggle and I really didn't get his voice right for like two or three drafts. And it was because he's such a sweetheart. And most of the characters I've written, even, I mean, I think they're mostly, I'm not saying I've written evil. they're quite nice, but they are more, I don't know, doubting, a little bit more cynical, a bit more, they have an edge and they're a bit sassier. And he's
very straight up. Like, he's just a sweetie.
You know, and if he makes a snarky comment, it has a really nice, you know, there's very little sting in his tail, and most of my characters have much more of a sting in their tail, and I find that easier to write.
He's really the sort of guy that you would have loved to have had as a friend. Yeah. That's what I think he would have been, he's someone that you want as a friend. He's lovely.
When you see the way characters react to him, like, you can imagine that the sort of character that Leilani is, mm-hmm. like, it's painted to be, you can imagine she's not the person who's most likely to run up to you and become your best friend out of nowhere. Mm. She's like, but she just adopts him. And, like, the way everyone meets him and reacts to him, and describes him as, like, a corn-fed farm boy and stuff. You just get this picture of this lovely, sweet guy who, you know, but then who does this violent sport of boxing and who is, like, babysitting a psychopath. So it's, like, a great black and white thing there. Like, he's in a situation that's, often in situations that are really disturbing or violent or scary, but he's just like the boy next door and you just love him. So, like, yeah, well done.
Well, he is kind of based on, you know, all through school, I mostly had female friends, but I always had kind of the occasional male friend, and they were always the guys who would get beaten up, who the other boys would pick on, like, who just were so sweet and so nice. And there's just a kind of Aussie guy that doesn't get written about, who is this guy who's really open and sweet and just assumes the best. And we've all known guys like this. And I just felt like they don't get written about that much. And so, and they certainly don't get to be a romantic hero that much. So, you know, so, I mean, it was important to me that he also has a love story to balance the central relationship in his life is, I mean, he's in an abusive relationship. You know, he almost has
PTSD.
Yeah. Like, because his parents,
they're not the best.
Yes.
And they're really, I mean, they're in denial about what Rosa is and they're not helping out. And he has basically been her parent since, you know, since she was born.
I was so impressed with this. I came up with something about unrelenting vigilance. And I thought, that's what it is, though. Yes. I felt
He's always on. He's always watching. And the rare times that he actually allows himself to do something that he wants to do, disaster ensues and Rosa does something horrible, and so he can't have anything, basically. And it's
like, he does have some happy moments. There are
The romance is sexy. I thought that was so hot. Like, I loved that, and I thought she was such a great character as well.
She's an amazing character. She's cool. Everyone, the book has, there's no background characters here. Everyone, even if they only show up briefly, is well-rounded and fully formed and realized and adds to the story. So, like, I remember thinking at one point that we had so many characters here where, like, a theme in this book to me was your physiology versus who you are on the inside and who you are really in your soul or whatever. And so you have a character like Elon who's, you know, got the issue of I'm not going to be able to express myself very well here, but, like, you've got a character who's where gender is
fluid,
not the point of their personality. Yeah, yeah. So they're actively not subscribing to a gender, and so that sort of echoes this idea that comes up later of if your brain is wired like a psychopath. Like if you have that physical sign of psychopathy, does that necessarily mean that you will become a psychopath? Like it's the nature versus nurture.
Yeah.
So I found that fascinating because if you view Rosa and Che as being siblings with the same
DNA.
Basic DNA and the same stuff going on in their brain physically, but they have
well the research that I did, and it was really fascinating because I mean I was looking at when William Marsh, and if I bugger up his name, I'm sorry, the guy who wrote The Bad Seed, which was also made into a truly terrible movie, forget the movie, the book is great. The research back then, it really was just nature versus nurture. What we knew about DNA was very, you know, not much.
Yeah.
And what, in the intervening, you know, 60 odd years, we now realize it's more of a tripartite division. So there's your DNA, there's your brain morphology, and then there's environment. But for a long time we thought DNA was fixed, but now we're discovering that DNA is not fixed at all. That your DNA can change in your lifetime, and that can be passed on to your children. So I know, it's really
so how
it's this whole new field of I think it's called epigenetics. So it's really fascinating to know that DNA is in fact not fixed. Brain morphology is not fixed either, because even if you're born with parts of your brain missing, other parts of your brain can take over and do that work. You can also have accidents that, you know, completely change your brain.
And it rewires itself to cope.
Yeah. And then, of course, your environment is completely variable as well. And the more research that's been done, we're also finding that, you know, environment can affect DNA. And environment can affect your brain morphology. But also, we're finding that kind of big environmental changes can have more of an effect on you. Like for a long time the research has shown that you can be more affected by your peers than your parents, even though your parents are like in your life more, but it's the kind of sudden impact of, you know, something dramatic happening. So, you know, people who experience death earlier shapes them in like really big ways. Trauma really shapes people. So there are all these things feeding in. So even if two people in the same family
with the same starting point,
environment. And just birth order makes a huge difference. What your parents were, I mean, you know, and there's a 7-year gap. So Rose is 10, Chase 17. You know, first born child, second born child, you know, and they moved a lot. But, you know, for most of Che's early years, they weren't moving around, so
he had a bit more stability.
Yeah, so there are all these different... But it's true of every single person. Like, a book you read can actually change who you are, you know? Like, have these incredible impacts. So the nature versus nurture thing, which was the big argument back in the 50s, is just ridiculous now. Because they're not separate things, you know? Like, it all
there's
just...
There's an equal basically, isn't it?
Yeah. And that's what I was trying to do in that book. I mean, part of why many of the characters seem very 3D is because that book was, like, 4 times the size. It's, like, the most bloated thing I have ever... And, like, it was just hacking because, I mean, I just put everything on the page.
And then had to trim it.
Yeah, and a lot of it did not need to be there. But it meant that because I knew so much about, everybody in that book. I mean, like, Che has 3 best friends who are back in Sydney.
And I loved that they were so present.
Yeah.
Unlike so often when you have particularly in YA, a book where your main character has been uprooted and they're in a new situation meeting new people, there's just, like, no sense of them
continuity,
being tied to their old friends. Like, maybe a mention or two in the beginning and then they drop off. But they're present the whole way through this, and it adds to Che's character as well, because you're like, even though he's been moving around the country and he's been away from all these people, they're still clearly so invested in his life and vice versa, which just proves what a lovely guy he is.
Well, I mean, we didn't mention the book is actually set in New York City, so, and he's from Sydney originally. The family are Australian. But for most of Rose's life, they've been moving from place to place, and kind of the reasons for that kind of become more apparent as you go on. So he's also, you know, a fish out of water. He's an Australian boy in New York City. So, so I was bringing some personal experience. Since 1999, I've lived back and forth between Sydney and New York City. And I'm, in fact, a dual citizen now. An Australian-American. and New York City is, I know it really, really well.
Which really comes
that
through.
Comes through,
yeah, a lot.
Yeah.
You really feel like there's a great sense of place in the book. There's no question that it's not a place that you're just writing about. Like,
but it was interesting writing it from Che's point of view because, I know it so well that I was forgetting what it was like when I was first there, like what it's like to be new in that city.
Yeah, and you know what? I love how you did that bit, and I think you did it really well because I found New York very confronting. And I used to go there for work a bit, and I was thinking I really related to Che and feeling that just not fast enough, not quick enough, not mean enough, not that anyone was ever impolite either. It wasn't that. I just felt really...
Oh, Lalani's pretty rude.
Yeah, she's
great.
But
I really enjoyed her.
I liked her character. Yeah.
There's just not a wasted character in the book. They're all amazing. And one thing I did want to... We're running over time, but I'm not going to stop because I want to ask you, in a book like this, there's a game-changer moment. And when you're writing, how difficult is it to not... Because it came to me as a big surprise. Like, it's not like I felt...
Me too.
But
it
made total sense.
Yeah,
it wasn't like,
what a writer.
Did it come out of nowhere? So, like, when you're putting a twist in your story, like, how hard is it to do it so perfectly where it's like, of course, but you never knew. Like,
well, there are multiple drafts. I mean, this book just went through so many, and it was so bloated. Oh, my God. You know, there are two big twists, and neither of them were in the first draft. So
I didn't
know that. So I'm not an outliner at all. I just figure it out as I go along.
Yeah, oh my gosh!
So I mean, I knew that.
It's difficult to talk.
I've been straying dangerously close to spoiler territory, so I'm going to dial it back. But
I knew that this was a book about a 17-year-old boy who's forced to be far more responsible than he should at that age.
He's basically
a parent when he shouldn't really be a parent. And I mean, and I have met so many teens who have been put in that position.
I love that about the book. I really think that so many people would relate to that and that idea of responsibility because you meet a lot of people who are doing lots of things that are very grown up at a young age. And also that idea too that parents aren't always particularly engaged. And I think you painted it. And you really feel for him because a lot of people can relate to that situation. Yeah. I thought it was beautifully done.
Yeah, so I really want to, so that was always there. And I also wanted to write a family that was, they're an awful family, but, so this is going to sound terrible, but we're kind of closer to the kind of family I grew up in. Now, my parents are wonderful, they're really lovely, but they've always been kind of very politically aware, and I grew up discussing politics at the dinner table. I was still a baby when I went to my first demonstration. Mm-hmm. There have always been, gay, lesbian, bi, trans people in my life. And I grew up talking about race and sex and sexuality and all of that kind of stuff. And so I wanted to draw a family like that. But my family's kind of boring. Like, you don't want a functional family. I don't write about functional families on the whole.
Not boring.
Yeah, no.
Well, I mean, that's not true. Team Human has a very functional family. Also very functional. I have written lots of functional families, but you have to have something big going on elsewhere.
Yeah.
Whereas this one, I really wanted to look at kind of the institution of the family and the ways in which it's a bit fucked up,
Well, because for the family to go on with life with Rosa in it, and to not have them throwing her in an institution, it has to be an offbeat family. You can't have, like, You have to be a peculiar family for that to happen.
Yeah, yeah. And I it was really important to me also, because I feel like in YA, I can think of lots of books, but there is a kind of tendency just generally in our genre and just in the general discussion to assume that dysfunctional families are working class families, whereas it cuts across the entire, like some of the most abused kids I've ever known have come from extremely wealthy families. And in doing the research about disturbed kids, and I was reading a lot about empathy and how it's developed and looking at lots of different case studies, and there are a lot of case studies of really upper class families whose kids were looked after by a series of nannies. And this is one extremely wealthy family, and the mother kept sacking the nanny as soon as the nanny bonded with the baby. Because the baby was supposed to bond with her, but she was she was seeing the baby like for a half hour a day. You know, and that kid grew up to be a psychopath. Well, he grew up to be a really horribly violent and is now in jail for a very long time for the things he's done. And so, you know, all of this stuff cuts across class. But the thing is that working class poorer families are more surveilled and are more likely to be, you know, to have social workers and the police intervene and to be thrown into jail. The kid, you know, there are these upper class, you know, richer kids who, you know, go on to be horrendous people and are never stopped. Like the affluenza. Have you been following that case in America?
No.
This Texas boy drunk drove and killed, I think he killed like 5 people. And his lawyer argued that he was suffering from affluenza, but because he was so wealthy, he'd never, you know, been told to behave well. You know, because his parents were shit, you know.
But in a way, that privileged lifestyle is almost a better breeding ground for a psychopath, because there are no consequences.
Does cut across classes. They appear in all works of life, but they get away with it more. Is the problem? Like, the more money you have, the better lawyers you can afford, and the more you can get away with.
You're super rich and your psychopath child does something bad, you've got all the lawyers in the world to get them out of it.
So I went down many rabbit holes of research, so I wanted to kind of bring many different things together.
That's what I love.
It was so bloated.
Yeah, but it's such a book of ideas. Yeah. And it is, once again, it's a very political book. And it's done in a way that's I think it's done beautifully, because it's Che coming to, and you've used New York so well to explore that canvas as well, I thought, for him. So because you're coming to it from Che's perspective, and it's this world unravelling for him, and him understanding that things are more layered than they seem, and there's things that he hasn't even considered. And I'm going to say her name wrong, so forgive me in advance. Sojourner.
Sojourner.
Sojourner is such a beautiful character. He's seeing the world through all his friends' eyes, through her eyes. He's seeing things differently. And for the first time, he's got more things to think about than just Rosa, as difficult as that is. So it's just fantastic in that sense, because when I was reading it, I love the fact it's just so, like I said to Justine, she's reached so far with it. And then I can see there's just been so much work done because she's pulled it off. It's very ambitious and she's done it. It's great. It's brilliant.
Yes, this technique of writing a really huge book is amazing.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, for both books, when I think that part of what enables you to do kind of more complex stuff is to hang it on a recognisable plot, really. I mean, thrillers, and Rosa, my sister Rosa, is a thriller, you know, like, and it's written to be a thriller. So there's this driving question, you know, what is Rosa going to do next? You know?
And it's always worse than you think it will be.
Just when. Yeah. Yeah.
And then, you know, so you have the driving thread of the thriller that enable, because you've got that structure and that driving mechanism, and it allows you to do a lot of stuff.
Because it's a page
turner.
It's an absolute, I could not put it down at all. I just found it was both these books were once singing for me.
I couldn't put either of them down. I had to take little breaks to
I'm working. I was reading Justine's book. I'm working. I'm not coming.
And Summer Skin is, you know, the structure is of a romance.
Yes.
And again, it gives you that driving force, you know. are they going to get together? How's it going to work out? Because they're so different. Like, this is, how are their friends going to deal with it?
Yeah.
Which is one of the things that in good romances, I really love it when there's this extended network of people who are also responding to the romance.
Because it should be more than just two people. Yeah. I think that's I've been going on about how different. I've been making a point of saying these are two vastly different books, but right down at the heart of things, they both are, you know, a romance and a thriller. So they're both doing one specific thing, but they're both so much more than that. So Summer Skin is a romance with so much more going on, and My Sister Rosa is a thriller with so much more going on. They're both really layered, rich books. And definitely, I know we're only 13 or so days into the year, but like, both definitely one of my favourite YA reads of this year.
Don't read anything else. That's good.
I think that's it for me in 2016.
That's good. We're done.
But yeah, what a great start off to the year. Like, they're going to be tough acts to follow. But guys, we've been going quite a long time. I think we have to wrap it up. But thank you so much for coming in, both of you.
Thank you very much for having us.
Yeah, and, great questions. This was really fun. Thank you.
Well, it was a pleasure to read both of your books. And for the listeners out there, I can't recommend them enough. My Sister Rosa and Summer Skin, both available from Booktopia.
Thanks for listening to the Booktopia podcast. And don't forget to subscribe to us on SoundCloud and iTunes. And if your eyeballs need a workout, check us out on YouTube at Booktopia TV. And don't forget, for all books featured on this episode and all episodes of the Booktopia podcast, head to Booktopia, Australia's local bookstore, at www.booktopia.com.au. Thanks for listening.